Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com.
Also, the Amanda Lester Detective book series for tweens and teens by former writing show producer and host Paula Berenstein, introducing Sherlock Holmes to the next generation. Find out more at amandalester.net. And the John H. Watson Society's monograph series for 2016, Sherlock Holmes and the Challenge of the Blank Page by Leah Gwynn. Order yours today at johnhwatsonsociety.com.
And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 90. Love in the Canon.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, well, well. It is February. And that month that's equally as hard to pronounce as it is to spell. And that means that it is the month of love here at I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
Wearing that beautiful Duchess of Devonshire hat, coquettishly lowered across one eye. How can you possibly see like that?
I have a veil that you can part. You know, like curtains. You just pull a string.
You must be a lodger. And I'm Burt Walder. And there we are.
And you look lovely as you framed yourself against the window.
Yes.
The light to your back.
So yes.
To disguise yourself.
Yes, yes. To call out the very fetching outline of my commanding figure.
Well,
that happened a lot in the Sherlock Holmes canon, actually.
That's true. That's true. More times than you'd care to count.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. You know what also happens a lot?
What?
I just read this statistic as I was putting my weekly newsletter together.
Hmm.
You have a smartphone.
As I do.
Many of us do. And whether you listen to the show on your phone or in the car or on your computer or whatever, doesn't matter. We probably are all familiar, at least, with the concept of smartphones. Evidently... 60% of clicks on mobile banner ads, that is banner ads that you come across when you're browsing the internet on your phone,
mm-hmm.
60% of clicks on those banner ads are accidental. people don't mean to click on them, at which if you turn it around, that means 40% actually do want to click on them, which that's the mind-boggling fact right there. I was surprised that was that high.
Yeah, I'm surprised, too. I'm surprised the 60% isn't higher.
That is. Well, you know, agencies need to account for something.
I got to call the plant and warn them.
The fingers you have used to dial are too fat. To obtain a special dialing wand, please mash the keypad with your palm now.
That's pretty much what's going on.
Oh, I like that.
In the ad world, you know?
Yeah.
So, well, we are here for I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 90, talking about love in the canon. This is posting the day after Valentine's Day, so we hope you had a lovely celebration, however you chose to celebrate.
Hmm.
And in the meantime, feel free to reach out and touch someone like us.
Yes, please.
Yes.
Give us a call, please. Look, folks, here's the inside story. We're lonely. Call us at 774-221-READ any time of the day or night. We will answer 774-221-7323 with a hopeful hello. And you can leave a message for us, which we will play endlessly over and over again, because, as I said a few moments ago, we're terribly lonely.
That is true. And, you know, if your fingers are too fat to dial the phone,
take your dialing wand.
Like, oh yeah, and you can't mash your fingers into the keypad. You might try emailing us.
Yes.
You can email us at comment@ihearofsherlock.com. You could even leave a comment on our website, ihearofsherlock.com.
Yeah. Now, the way you do that, you know, is not the way you would think. I mean, you can't look at the website and suddenly start talking to it. There's got some clicking involved here. So just turning up IHOs, you know, ihearofsherlock.com and saying, damn you, website, is not going to do any good. You might try saying, Siri, damn this website, Siri, and see what happens.
Well, and then we'll be haunted with the denial of service attacks.
Oh, that's right. Never mind.
Crazy. So yes. if that doesn't work for you, try us on the social web.
Yes.
We are all over the internets.
Go to our Facebook page. See what good that'll do you.
We've had a lot of growth on our Facebook page. We are now up to almost 6,000 fans.
We need more.
We always need more. But what could really help us out the most, if you haven't done so yet, is get over to iTunes and leave us a review.
Please do.
It's probably one of the most helpful things you can do to help with visibility here and help other people listen to cool stuff.
Yes, and always remember those important keywords when you write your review. Words like passable and distracting.
And cash only. That always helps.
Yes.
Well, speaking of cash only, that makes me think of our sponsor.
Oh, that was fast.
You know, we have sponsors. Well, we have four sponsors on this show. We need to get these out of the way.
Friends, this is the all-sponsor show. It's a couple of jingles, a few sound effects, and some commercials, and then we're done.
That was a nice show. Let's do it again sometime.
Let's do it again. Goodbye.
Who's our first sponsor?
Our first sponsor is the beautiful, the talented Wessex Press. Come on down, Wessex Press.
Well, last time we talked with you about A Curious Collection of Dates, and that's a great book, and you should keep thumbing through that if you have got it. But we don't want to be too repetitive here.
No.
So we're looking now at Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in The Newspapers, Volume 2, January through June 1893.
6 months of 1893.
This is the height of when the adventures and memoirs were being published, right? June of 93, I think that's when the final problem hit the newsstands in the Strand magazine. And you will see in, I think it is late June, 1893, Sherlock Holmes is dead. apologies if we didn't issue a spoiler alert there, but it was quite shocking to people at the time that Conan Doyle would go ahead and do what he did to his historic creation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this would be akin to, something modern. J.K. Rowling killing off Harry Potter in the midst of the series, just as it was at its height of interest. So you can read exactly what the newspapers had to say about this happening in real time.
Mm-hmm. And although we did skip over it, don't forget A Curious Collection of Dates, because their entry for February 14 is a Valentine for Sherlock Holmes.
Ooh.
And the quotation is, he clapped his hand into his pocket and I raised the pistol from the table, but he merely drew out a memorandum book in which he'd scribbled some notes. as befits a man whose vocation once consisted of precise observations and calculation, Professor Moriarty is an organized man. However, as he made his chronologically listed litany of complaints, he seems to lose focus. After the specific dates of January 4th and 23rd, he fumbles a bit and says that Holmes seriously inconvenienced him by the middle of February. Now, perhaps he was, you know, just flipping through his memorandum book, but it could be he suddenly realized that he had neglected to send a Valentine's Day card to Sherlock Holmes.
It could happen.
It could happen. Yeah.
It could happen.
Yes.
Well, send a Valentine's Day card to our friends at West Express in the form of a check.
Yes.
To order one of these fine books, get over to WestExpress.com and tell them I hose sent ya.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we should get to the heart of the matter here. You get that one?
Yeah.
We're talking about love, romance in the canon, the ladies, the men, the missed connections, the adulterous affairs.
Good grief.
The double crossings. The true loves. There's a lot of it in the canon. As I was kind of a comprehensive listing, I realized that a true comprehensive listing of all the forms of love and relationships in the canon would be too long for this humble show. But romance actually formed quite a bit of what Conan Doyle wrote in the Sherlock Holmes stories. So where would you like to start, Mr.
Well, Ward? I think a good place to start is this very false picture of Holmes as a misogynist. And I think a lot of that originates from Sign of Four. You know, when there are so many memorable little moments in there. One is, of course, at the end when Watson tells Holmes that he is engaged to Mary Morstan, or that she has accepted him as a prospective husband. He issues this dismal groan. I really cannot congratulate you. Now, he acknowledges Mary is one of the most charming young ladies. So it shows that he's sensitive and aware of her charms and of women's charms. But then goes on, of course, to say, I assure you the most winning woman I ever knew was
hanged for poisoning
her children for the insurance money.
Right.
And he goes on to say, you know, women are never to be entirely trusted. And elsewhere there, he says, love is an emotional thing, and whatever is emotional is opposed to that true cold reason which I place above all things. I should never marry myself, lest I bias my judgment. Now, I think that's actually, that last quote is not particularly properly appreciated. Holmes said, I should never marry myself, which indicates a degree of narcissism, I think, that has not been appropriately.
Or onanism.
That's right. Investigate. For those of you. I should never marry myself, but I am looking very fetching today. Lest I bias my judgment.
Well, I mean, that's telling, because on one hand, you could look at that and say, well, Holmes was asexual, as many have stated over the years, that he had no interest in the fairer sex. But to me, if you look at it from a slightly different angle, I think it means that he did.
Mm-hmm.
And that he knew that his career, his position, his ability to effectively do what he does would be compromised should he put himself in some sort of romantic situation.
Well, I think that's true. And for the world's first unofficial consulting detective, you need to be aware of the motivations that drive people, the motivations towards gain, financial gain, the motivations for revenge, and all of these motivations that feature so prominently in the canon, the motivations of love and desire and possession, rank equally hard. In fact, it's hard to find in the canon, the 56 short stories and the 4 novels, to find one that doesn't touch somewhere on affection and emotion and love.
You know, that's a good point.
So, for example, in Case of Identity, Holmes knows that Mary Sutherland's oscillation upon the pavement, probably indicated an affair of the heart. But because she's not more vigorously banging down the door of 221B, she'd not been seriously wronged. Well, that's, you know, an extraordinary conclusion to come to from observation, but obviously there's deep knowledge behind that.
Hmm. Well, I think that's a great observation. Hmm. You know, by just a simple physical characteristic, a physical trait like that, being able to deduce something that's and, you know, much deeper.
And there's a whole range of these things that suggest that Holmes' knowledge of emotion and love was really rather deep. In Beryl Coronet, he tells Alexander Holder that his niece was one of those women in whom the love of a lover extinguishes all other loves. Well, now that's also, you know, an extraordinary bit of knowledge that he's squirreled away in his brain attic. In Musgrave Ritual, he's aware of Rachel Howell's fiery and passionate emotions for the butler Brunton. In Twisted Lip, he observes that he had seen too much not to know that the impression of a woman may be more valuable than the conclusion of an analytical reasoner.
Well, and that's an interesting one, too, because in The Man with the Twisted Lip, Mrs. Sinclair insisted, "Oh, you must not discourage me, Mr. Holmes. I know that all is well with him. There is so keen a sympathy between us that I should know if evil came upon him."
Mm.
I think Holmes, while he didn't share that understanding, he appreciated it.
Yeah, and in Twisted Lip also he describes her as this dear little woman. Mm. Yeah, and in Illustrious Client, he knew that it might be something less than a capital crime that might turn poor old infatuated Violet de Merville against Baron Gruner. He says murder might be condoned or explained, and yet some smaller offense might rankle.
That's true. And, you know, when it comes to the Baron Gruner-Violet de Merville relationship, as it was described to Holmes, I think it was who came to visit him there? Sir James Damery described the relationship between Violet and the Baron as follows. "The strongest of all holds where a woman is concerned, the hold of love. The fellow is, as you may have heard, extraordinarily handsome, with a most fascinating manner, a gentle voice, and that air of romance and mystery, which means so much to a woman. He is said to have the whole sex at his mercy, and to have made ample use of the fact."
Hmm.
So, you know, when you're going up against, you know, that kind of opponent who seems to have a complete hold over his beloved, or at least his intended, it becomes pretty difficult. And that's why, of course, they brought in Kitty Winter with her previous experience with the Baron and her knowledge of some of his possessions. She said, "I tell you, Mr. Holmes, this man collects women and takes pride in his collection, as some men collect moths or butterflies. He had it all in that book: snapshot photographs, names, details, everything about them." This is this first example, I think, of binders full of women. Remember that from the 2012 election. Binders full of women. But that's what it took to break that hold over Violet de Merville. Mm.
Well, and Holmes also is a great comforter of the women that he comes across. He comforts Helen Stoner. He says to her, "You must not fear," said he soothingly, bending forward and patting her forearm. "We shall soon set matters right, I have no doubt." In Second Stain, Lady Hilda Trelawney Hope, another great character. You know, she of the queenly presence, tall, graceful, intensely womanly, and of the beautiful, haunted face and the startled eyes and the drawn mouth. You know, it's quite a lovely little sketch there. Now, admittedly, that's not Holmes, but Holmes raises her up after she throws herself at his feet and restores her peace of mind. So he's very protective of women. Of course, Frances Carfax, you know, that's a rare case in which I don't think any emotion or affection really features significantly, but he observes that, a woman traveling alone is a prime victim. So he's got these great instincts. And he defends Hattie Duran in Noble Bachelor, she who was as a fascinating young lady. I think it's someone remarks, possessed of a graceful figure and striking face. And then there's Violet Hunter in Copper Beaches. You know, he begins by saying, oh, my poor practice has really hit bottom now that I'm advising, schoolmistresses about, or governesses about jobs they should take. But as soon as he sees her with her luxuriant chestnut hair and her bright, quick face, he says to her, anytime, day or night, a telegram would bring me down to your help. And he thought her a quite exceptional woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, he clearly has deep knowledge and deep feelings.
Deep appreciation, yeah. Yeah. Well, there were, I think there were also examples, if we flip this around, of some women who were extraordinarily dedicated in their love to their fiancés or their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
Sticking with the Noble Bachelor, Hattie Duran, mm-hmm. who of course had been secretly married before she met Robert St. Simon, said, still, if I had married Lord St. Simon, of course I'd have done my duty by him.
Hmm.
We can't command our love, but we can our actions. That was very telling. Someone who would stand by, and even though she wasn't necessarily marrying for love, would be willing to do her duty.
Hmm.
Another duty-bound mistress was Annie Harrison in the Naval Treaty. Now, this is, of course, the tale when Percy Phelps lost a document of national and international importance,
mm-hmm.
and who stayed by his bedside as his nurse, his day nurse, for 9 weeks, but Annie Harrison. And she was even willing to do what Holmes asked and sit in that room all by herself when the group of them left. So a woman who was more than willing to act in the best interest of her her beloved.
Yeah, very good example.
Yeah. Other duty-bound women. Let's see. Well, it's funny. In Thor Bridge, the problem of Thor Bridge, you had, it was a love triangle. And there are quite a few love triangles in the canon.
Hmm.
But in this case, Neil Gibson, J. Neil Gibson, the Gold King, an American senator, had fallen out of love with his wife, Maria, who, by the way, was a creature of the tropics, tropical by birth and tropical by nature, a child of the sun and of passion.
Mm.
She had loved him as much as such women can love, but when her own physical charms had faded, there was nothing to hold him. And Gibson himself said that she was a rare and wonderful in her beauty, a deep, rich nature too, passionate, wholehearted, tropical, ill-balanced, very different from the American women I had known. But on the other hand, you've got Grace Dunbar, who has taken over as the governess to his children in the house, and there he was faced with this beautiful woman every day. He said, I could not live under the same roof with such a woman and in daily contact with her without feeling a passionate regard for her.
Mm.
I never wanted anything more than the love and possession of that woman. And she held him off. She held him to a standard. She made sure that he did the right thing.
Mm.
And even as she was accused of the murder of her passionate rival in Mrs. Gibson, she stuck to what was right and what was true.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Although, that particular story, if you were to look at this as a story rather than a case of Sherlock Holmes, one might say that, this is where the author's, the sensibilities that prevailed when the author wrote this have not really held up very well over time. I mean, the fact is, you know, Gibson himself is pretty callow, kind of a cad. I mean, you know, why did he marry Maria in the first place?
Well, he must have been on some expedition in Brazil, you know, met and fell in love with this fiery beauty.
Yeah.
But you know what?
But clearly didn't make any great commitment.
No. I mean, it was, and look, it was very much a case of beauty is only skin deep.
Mm.
You know, after her beauty faded, his interest waned.
Yeah.
Very fickle. And, I think that does hold up. You know, I mean, how many trophy wives and, generation gap marriages do you see where the gentleman is older and the lady is much younger?
I've always thought what a wonderful, amazing coincidence that is, that the the husband seems to be very old and very rich. It's just astonishing.
Yeah.
And just obviously a complete coincidence.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I think that's still very much a part of human nature, and I don't think it's only contained. At least this love of looks and beauty are just contained to the male half of the species. And there's an example in The Crooked Man.
Oh, right,
right. Henry Wood, who of course was the Crooked Man, he and Nancy then DeVoy, now Barclay, were. Were attached to one another before he was sent off to the mutiny by Colonel Barclay.
Hmm.
And he said that she was the finest girl that ever had the breath of life between her lips. However, and this is a subtle throwaway line, but it's worth noting, it was for my good looks that she loved me.
Well, I wonder why he said that, though. I mean, is there any evidence, really, in that case to support that statement that it was for
well,
his good
I think
looks
it's
that she
it probably drawing the contrast between the twisted beast that he has become after 30 years of torture and travel and everything. You know, becoming the crooked man. It's almost a Beauty and the Beast kind of thing. Where he was once this striking man.
Yeah, but that's maybe his feeling and not necessarily Nancy's. And in fact, you know, she's thunderstruck when she sees him again.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So one could say that her love, you know, for him endures and re-sparks when she sees him.
It could be, but we never find out what happens after the adventure concludes, you know, when she recovers and, you know, where does he go after that?
Mm.
But, you know, the fate that Colonel Barclay was met with, you know, that was the ultimate fate after having betrayed his comrade. You know, we see this notion of betrayal being revisited and remet with regard to romance. Mm. I think one of the starkest images of betrayal and infidelity is in The Cardboard Box.
Mm.
You know, another love triangle where you had Jim Browner, who was caught between two sisters. There were three sisters altogether. The older one, didn't matter. She was a good woman. But he said the second was a devil and the third was an angel. And it was the devil, Sarah Cushing, who loved her. He said, she loved me until all her love turned to poisonous hate. When she knew that I thought more of my wife's footmark in the mud than I did of her whole body and soul. So she made it her business, after having been soundly rejected by her brother-in-law, to break up the marriage. Mm. And encouraged her sister Mary to start seeing Alex Fairbairn while her husband was away at sea. And then, of course, he discovers that betrayal and murders the two of them and then sends an ear from each one of them to the wrong sister. But that was the price of betrayal.
Well, there speaks some, certainly some deep knowledge of emotion, betrayal, jealousy, possession, rivalry among sisters.
There was also betrayal involved in two other stories, late stories, The Veiled Lodger, right? Eugenia Ronder, had married the circus master, Ronder, mm-hmm. and he turned out to be a horrible man. And she found interest in Leonardo, the strong man. She said, "Leonardo came more and more into my life. You see what he was like," and she had a picture of this striking man. "I know now the poor spirit that was hidden in that splendid body, but compared to my husband, he seemed like the angel Gabriel. He pitied me and helped me until at last our intimacy turned to love, deep, deep, passionate love, such as a love I had dreamed of but never hoped to feel." And then, of course, Leonardo was a coward through and through, and didn't go through with their plan. As the lion broke free, he fled, leaving her to face the beast. Mm. And again, you know, it's an instance of there being some infidelity and fate being met upon one of the adulterers. Then the other one, the retired colorman.
You know, it's the old story, Watson, a treacherous friend and a fickle wife.
Not a good situation. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the, I think, one of the most twisted individuals in the canon. He doesn't get a lot of play, but Josiah Amberley. here's one of those old rich guys with a young wife, right?
Mm-hmm. Just needs the monkey glands, that's all.
Yeah. Oh, that's another one, too. We'll get to that in a minute. You know, his wife ceased to love him for whatever reason. There was a friendly neighbor, Dr. Ray Ernest, and the intimacy between he and Mrs. Amberley was a natural sequence.
For you must admit that our unfortunate client has few outward graces, whatever his inner virtues may be.
Yeah. And he was just a nasty man. So what did he do? He locked them both in a room and turned up the gas and killed them.
That's pretty. Yeah, that's. I would take offense at that.
Yeah, you think? Amazing.
See here, I would say. See here, Amberley. It's all well and good, you know, to play pawn the king four, but this gas business has got to stop.
And then, we just mentioned monkey gland.
Mm-hmm.
Who was that intended for?
Oh, Professor Presbury.
The serum of languor.
Mm.
This was the original Viagra.
Well, it was the original something.
The canonical Viagra. This was essentially, you know, it was an older man, again, interested in a younger woman. And what did he need? He needed a little bit of nature's help to to have him feeling a little more frisky. It was his secretary who said it was not, as I understand, the reasoned courting of an elderly man, but rather the passionate frenzy of youth, for no one could have shown himself a more devoted lover. The lady, Alice Morphy, was a very perfect girl, both in mind and body, so that there was every excuse for Professor Presbury's infatuation. Again, with the infatuation. He had a rough time of it. After that, we also had infatuation mentioned in The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Oh, yeah. Well, The Hound of the Baskervilles, you know, is quite a complicated story there.
It is.
Beryl and Stapleton and Sir Henry and, you know, Mrs. Barrymore and her husband and her brother.
Yeah, I mean, talk about the Barrymores, the love they had for each other. Hiding her brother, and Barrymore not willing to take the fall for his wife, looking to protect her at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
Beryl Stapleton, of course, another South African beauty, South American beauty, rather. Mm. Sir Henry was infatuated with her. Of course, her quote-unquote brother was not too pleased about that arrangement. Almost blew the cover at that point.
And then you've got, you know, Laura Lyons in there.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And poor old Sir Charles.
Yeah. You think there was any romance going on there?
No, I don't think so.
No? You think he hoped for romance?
Oh, I think so. I think.
Maybe that's how he died. Was he out running for some serum of languor that evening? Could have been. He was being chased by a dog, just like Roy was going nuts in,
that's right.
in The Creeping Man. The dog, you know, not taking kindly to its master, taking monkey serum.
Yeah, that's right. Could be.
Well, that brings me at least to the last reference I wanted to make.
Mm.
Actually, there's three more. Two are on the tragic side. There always tends to be some sort of, some sort of device, some sort of, whether it's a plot device or a situation that keeps lovers from either consummating their relationship or realizing their ultimate happiness. Of course, you had Mrs. Godfrey Staunton, who was never named, in The Missing Three-Quarter. Of course, Staunton became passionately attached to her when she was his landlady's daughter. They secretly married. And then he was making these trips to the countryside to be with her as she died of consumption. Mm. Now, wasn't consumption
TB
or tuberculosis, wasn't that what Conan Doyle's first wife was diagnosed with?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Jean? Was it Jean?
Louise. Was it Tui? Wasn't it Louise, Tui. I thought?
Yeah. Yeah, Jean was his second wife.
Yeah.
There's a perfect example, right, of Conan Doyle striking up this supposedly platonic friendship with Jean while Tui was in her sickbed for many, many years. I think it was a good 15 years or so that she survived like that. And then, of course, you've got Captain Crocker and Lady Brackenstall in the Abbey Grange.
Mm-hmm.
He killed her husband because of the maltreatment there, but was going to be, I think Holmes gave him a year to go around the world, do his thing, and let the two of them get back together eventually. But that true dedication there. From the first day I met her, she was the only woman to me. Every day of the voyage, I loved her more, and many a time since, I've kneeled down in the darkness of the night watch and kissed the deck of that ship, because I knew her dear feet had trod on it. That's a little extreme,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you think about it.
Yeah. Well, and then there's, you know, Devil's Foot and Brenda Tregennis and Dr. Leon Sterndale.
That's one of the most tragic.
Well, it's another case where Holmes lets the murderer go off and return to do his good work in another part of the world. But also, you know, speaking of Conan Doyle, I mean, Conan Doyle was, among other things, a proponent for divorce reform in England. And Leon, Dr. Sterndale, says for years he's loved Brenda, but he couldn't marry her because I have a wife who left me years ago, but because of these deplorable laws of England, I could not divorce, and Brenda waited, and for years I waited, and now it's all over.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, even though Holmes let him go, I mean, what did he have to live for other than his work after that, you know?
Mm. Now, where we deserve kudos from our listeners is we've had this whole discussion about love in the canon and all of these various situations, and we never mention Scandal in Bohemia.
Well, that kind of goes without need for mention. I mean, the woman, and that's almost the subtext of the entire canon.
Mm. Well, the wonderful thing about it is it's one of the few pictures in the canon. In fact, I can't think of another similar one of, of course, it's hard for me to divorce in my head the text of the case, the text of the story, and the various dramatizations that I've seen.
Yeah.
Because the image that you have of Irene is formed through all of those things. And I remember Gail Honeycutt in the Jeremy Brett story. You know, they had shot these little snippets of her riding with the king, of her shooting with the king, of her dancing with the king, of her...
Yeah.
You know, and she's, clearly enjoying life, participating, an equal, a real partner to the king and court life there in those clips. And therefore, among the most remarkable women ever penned in the canon.
Yeah. Yeah, it undoubtedly, I think it, and this was one of the first episodes of the Granada series. I think it set the tone for everything that was to come after that.
Mm-hmm.
And really gave you a sense as to how smitten Holmes was of this woman, and yet how he forcibly downplayed it.
Mm.
You know? And that's interesting because at the other end of the canon, if we get to the Adventure of the Lion's Mane, which was told by Holmes himself, we meet Maud Bellamy.
Mm-hmm.
And
the beauty of the neighborhood.
Yeah. Maud doesn't get a lot of playtime the way Irene Adler did. And maybe because the entire story doesn't really center around romance, doesn't center around a relationship. It centers around, you know, a death. But what Sherlock Holmes himself said of her, I thought, was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There was no gainsaying that she would have graced any assembly in the world. Who could have imagined that so rare a flower would grow from such a root and in such an atmosphere? Women have seldom been an attraction to me, for my brain has always governed my heart. But I could not look upon her perfect, clear-cut face with all the soft freshness of the downlands and her delicate coloring, without realizing that no young man would cross her path unscathed. That's pretty powerful language right there.
Yeah, it's true. Well, and, you know, there are a couple of different intonations possible there. I mean, Holmes could also have said, women have seldom been an attraction to me, for my brain has always governed my heart, but I could not look upon her perfect, clear-cut face with all the soft freshness of the downlands and her delicate coloring without realizing that, that no young man could cross her path unscathed. He could have said that too.
And maybe he did.
Maybe Yeah. And yet, no mention of greeting cards or chocolates or diamonds or all of the things that seem to characterize Valentine's Day in the 21st century.
Well, he did, of course, in the Naval Treaty, have that soliloquy to the rose.
Oh, that's true.
But it was really kind of a love poem to scientific reasoning.
Yes.
What a lovely thing a rose is. There is nothing in which deduction is so necessary as in religion. It can be built up as an exact science by the reasoner. The highest assurance of the goodness of Providence seems to me to rest in the flowers. It is only goodness which gives extras. And so I say again, we have much to hope from the flowers.
Yeah, we never did find out who Rose was.
It wasn't Gypsy Rose, Lee? Ah, you hear all those shekels pouring in?
Oh, my goodness. It must be another day at the Amanda Lester storefront.
It sure is. However did you guess?
I never guess. It is destructive of the logical faculties.
That is true. Well, of course, if you've heard us talk before on this show about Amanda Lester Detective, you will be aware that there are three books in this series by Paula Berenstein and the precocious 12-year-old Amanda Lester, who is a scion of Inspector Lestrade himself, much to her consternation. You know, you think most 12- and 13-year-olds are embarrassed by their parents? Imagine if Inspector Lestrade was part of your family tree, and you were trying to become a burgeoning detective. Imagine the embarrassment there.
would be the same as having Dr. Crippen on your family tree.
But this is a marvelous series. It's a fun way to involve kids in the detective fiction genre in a fun kind of non-Sherlockian way, yet still espousing some of those same types of traits that you'll see in Sherlock Holmes, and almost putting a Harry Potter type twist on them, kind of an adventure series. And I know Paula is busy at work on the fourth entry in the series, which will be out in April. So we will bring you news of that fourth one as it comes to bookstores everywhere. But in the meantime, if you get over to amandalester.net, you can check out all three titles right now, from Amanda Lester and the Pink Sugar Conspiracy to Amanda Lester and the Orange Crystal Crisis and Amanda Lester and the Purple Rainbow Puzzle. So pink, orange, and purple. We'll see what color comes next in the cycle. I think if she does it well, she'll have an entire rainbow of Amanda Lester books to choose from by the end of it all.
I bet.
get on over there to amandalester.net.
I bet Violet must be coming up pretty soon.
Violet, that would be entirely canonical.
Very canonical.
I know. How many Violets were there in the canon?
1,000.
Seemingly so.
It's like that old Monty Python routine at the University of Woolloomooloo in Australia, where this fellow shows up and he's quickly dubbed New Bruce because everyone there is named Bruce. Remember that?
New Bruce. I love that. Yeah. I love that.
Oh, New Violet.
Do you know how many Violets there were in the canon?
I don't remember. 5 or 6, no?
There were 4.
Ah, 4. All right.
Now, I was going to ask
Violet
you
Hunter, name Violet them. De Merville.
Yes, it's 2. And the stories from which in which they were mentioned. So Violet de Merville.
Violet de Merville is Lester's client, and Violet Hunter is Coppa Beaches, obviously.
Okay, that's 2.
And Violet, I don't remember the other two Violets.
Violet quickly. Westbury.
Westbury. Violet
you remember
Westbury.
Her?
No, I don't remember her.
She was the fiancée of the victim in the Bruce Partington plans.
Oh, right. Right.
Miss Violet Westbury. They were supposed to go to the theater that night.
Right.
And what was his name? Another name I'm blanking on now.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Well, it's retrieval. Information storage is easy. It's retrieval that's the challenge.
Right.
You need new Sherlock Holmes brand genetic memory.
Cadogan West.
Oh, all right.
She was Cadogan waiting for West. Cadogan West, Arthur Cadogan West, to pick her up. So those are three Violets, Smith, de Merville, Westbury, and... Come on.
Beats me.
Fine. We mentioned her.
I'm sure we did.
Hunter.
Oh, didn't we say Hunter?
Violet Hunter. You said Smith, I thought.
No, I said Violet Hunter.
Oh, you said Hunter?
Copper Beaches.
Then it's Smith.
Ah, Smith. Violet Smith.
Solitary cyclist.
Well, of course I couldn't remember Violet Smith. It's such an unusual name.
I was thinking, silly me, I was thinking Violet Jones. what are you going to do?
Violet Cadwallader, how are you? I've always thought, you know, that Whitehall Lane would be a great name for a Sherlockian character. I can see someone coming to Baker Street at home saying, "Come in, Mr. Whitehall Lane."
I like that. Well, it seems like it is time for...
Yes, yes.
The news.
Oh, the news!
Always a good tone when you can hear it. You know there's something that's about to happen. Breaking news. Wow. What was it? HBO's not necessarily the news. Their line was, "When news breaks, we fix it." So what's been going on in the news world of Sherlock Holmes lately?
Well, a lot of it has been on our flipbook page. I was really intrigued by the
music, by the review of the musical that's in Chicago. I mean, the review is very well written, and it's accompanied by some photographs. But I must say, I don't...
What's the name of the musical?
The Man Who Murdered Sherlock Holmes. I must say, I don't immediately resonate to the story, because the story has, is basically, as I gather, is basically puts Holmes and Conan Doyle on the same stage, and the idea is that Holmes convinces Conan Doyle. It appears to mix sort of the Final Problem in the Edelgie case. And has Holmes, as a fictional character, encouraging Conan Doyle to think like a detective and to investigate these happenings.
Well, that's interesting, because just as a contrast to that, we recently lost the actor Frank Finlay.
Mm.
And Finlay, among playing Inspector Lestrade in two Sherlock Holmes and Jack the Ripper movies, Murder by Decree and Study and Terror, he also played Conan Doyle in a fairly little-known movie called The Other Side, a television movie called The Other Side.
Oh, I had never seen that.
And evidently he is at a seance, and in the seance he is brought into touch with Sherlock Holmes, who takes him to task for killing him off, I guess.
Mm.
So an interesting flip side there of the scientific Doyle versus the spiritualistic Doyle with Frank Finlay's demise.
Well, I mean, if I was in Chicago, I would certainly see the show.
Yeah.
They seem to have cast a fellow who looks very Watsonian as Conan Doyle.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good move, right?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, Conan Doyle, you know, was a big, strapping athlete, and
Watson wasn't.
Well, there again, you know, your impressions of Watson are colored by all of the representations you've seen about him on screen. I do tend to think of Watson as, a retired military officer. I mean, military manner, military bearing, fit, not, sort of round and phlegmatic.
Well, it depends on how round.
Yeah.
What was it? It was at the end of Charles Augustus Milverton when Holmes and Watson were escaping, and Lestrade described them. He said, the first fellow was a bit too active, but the second was caught by the undergardener. He got away after a struggle. He was middle-sized, strongly built man, square jaw, thick neck, mustache.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not rounded, but it is certainly larger than the rail thin Watson that we met in the opening lines of A Study in Scarlet.
Well, that's true, but he'd been ill.
Thin as a lath, I think you said.
Right.
That's true.
Right.
That's true.
But he'd been ill. No, that is right. Middle sized. But Conan Doyle himself was not middle sized.
Well,
I think he was a big strapping guy.
Yeah.
But there you go. I mean, you know, you want the story to work on the stage. You know, it's not supposed to be the goal isn't to deliver the world's best impersonation of Arthur Conan Doyle. The goal is to deliver an entertaining musical for the audience.
That is true. I can't imagine in the few recordings that we have of Conan Doyle, I cannot imagine him singing. that would be something different.
I never thought of that. Conan Doyle singing. I can't get away to marry you today. My wife won't let me. Yeah, I don't think. Another beer, Sir Arthur. Thank you. Thank you. Think I don't mind if I do.
Oh, boy.
Well, sadly, so Frank Finlay has passed away, and Alan Rickman has passed away.
Yeah,
who once played Sherlock Holmes? That's been in the news.
Yeah, Pikachu.
God bless you.
Thank you. I was expecting that. The Nintendo game, the Great Detective Pikachu, is out now. Of course, Pikachu is one of the video game heroes in Japanese culture, and there evidently is this this new version of the Pikachu. It looks something like a rabbit, but isn't a rabbit, running around with a deerstalker cap on. Don't really have more to report on it other than that. But
I think you've got enough there.
Well, one of our one of our correspondents, Rachel Gosh, has taken this as an opportunity to talk about Sherlock Holmes and Japanese culture and how, the influence of Sherlock Holmes in Japan and the many Sherlock Holmes clubs over there, including the largest one, which is, of course, the aptly named Sherlock Holmes, Japan Sherlock Holmes Club.
Mm.
How about that?
Very good.
And, of course, the I think the first volume of the BSI International series was Japan and Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
Now unavailable. And then if you are in Canada, specifically if you're in Edmonton, that will be the only place that you get to see the Sherlock Holmes exhibition in Canada as it makes its way out there. The International Exhibition of Sherlock Holmes at the TELUS World of Science. Starting in March of 2016 in Edmonton. And I saw it in Columbus. One of our correspondents saw it in Denver. And it's been fairly well received at every stop.
Hmm.
So for our fellow Canucks, we hope you have a chance to get to Alberta. Maybe see a late season Oilers game and get over to the museum.
And then the Abominable Bride has been in the news with a roundup of reviews and commentary about it. You know, one of the things I notice is that in the posters and in the art that they did for Abominable Bride, they show Cumberbatch and Freeman, much like Downey and Jude Law appeared in the posters for their films. And they show Freeman and Cumberbatch, not surprisingly, at the same eye level. But Freeman is a good, 4 inches or so shorter than Cumberbatch.
Yeah.
And to our previous commentary about the size of Watson, Freeman, I suppose, really is, a mid-size guy and probably very well cast physically.
Yeah.
To the supposedly taller and more angular Holmes.
He's about the same size as Robert Downey Jr., I think.
Oh, Freeman?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, all that and more. If you want to keep up with Sherlockian news on a regular basis, certainly tune into our site, get email updates from ihearofsherlock.com, but also check out the I Hear of Sherlock Flipboard magazine. You can take that with you on the go, on your phone, your tablet, or what have you. It's a great way to keep up with the news in between our biweekly episodes here.
Yes, indeed.
Well, and with that stately music.
you know what I wish
what?
I had with that
What's
stately
that?
Music? I wish I had a monograph to read.
Well, really?
Yeah.
I think I might know a place where you can get one.
What?
Yes.
Monographsrus.com?
Almost.
Oh.
JohnHWatsonSociety.com.
Oh, I'm a member of that.
This time around, the 2016 entry in the monograph series is Sherlock Holmes and the Challenge of the Blank Page by Leah Gwynne.
Hmm.
Now, that name, Leah Gwynne, is one that you're going to hear quite a bit around I Hear of Sherlock this year.
Leah Gwynne, Leah Gwynne,
Sherlock
Leah
everywhere.
Gwynne, Leah Gwynne, Leah Gwynne, Leah Gwynne, Leah Gwynne.
There you go. I think we've got our quota in. Yeah. Leah, of course, is the co-author with Jamie Mahoney of A Curious Collection of Dates that we mentioned earlier in the show.
Hmm.
But in this case, with the John H. Watson Society manuscript series, Leah uses her observations gleaned over years of following these Sherlockian exploits and Sherlockian fiction to put together an entertaining and useful handbook on how to create a good pastiche. That's fantastic. You know, with all the pastiches that we see coming out, I'm sure authors could use a guidebook on how to create a good pastiche. Learn what good canon faithful stories require, some of the pitfalls to avoid, how to pull off a successful alternative universe, research aids, and other various bits and bobs to help them make a successful further adventure. And this is the key. Have fun while doing it, right? If you want to be a published pastiche-ure, are you sure you want to be a published pastiche-ure? Then this is the place to understand why that otherwise well-written story left you unmoved or unconvinced, how to inspire yourself to write with confidence and read with insight and precision. So pre-orders for the monograph, which will be published in April, are being accepted now through the John H. Watson Society shop over at johnhwatsonsociety.com. $15 domestic, $20 international. That gives you the print version, and that makes sure that you'll get that highly collectible physical copy. Now, once these print copies sell out, not to worry, they will still be available electronically as a PDF. And that will be available for $10, right? So get on over to johnhwatsonsociety.com and don't be left searching eBay in years to come for that increasingly expensive copy of Sherlock Holmes and the Challenge of the Blank Page by Leah Gwynn.
My mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram, the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my proper atmosphere. Then I can dispense with artificial stimulants. But I abhor the dull routine of existence. I crave mental exaltation.
Welcome to the I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere quiz program called Mental Exaltation. If you've ever listened to NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or Weekend Edition Sunday with Will Shortz, you'll be familiar with our format. But just in case you haven't, here's how it works. Each episode, we post a qualifying question on the website, ihearofsherlock.com, and of all the correct answers submitted, an individual will be chosen at random to become a contestant on Mental Exaltation. So, in this case, Bert, who do we have on the show?
We have prominent Sherlockian John C. Sherwood.
From
beautiful Marshall, Michigan, Scott.
Excellent. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor.
Well, it's nice to have a fellow Michigander on the show.
Oh, yeah.
I want to hear a little bit about your Sherlockian bona fides before we get into the quiz here. What are you known for in the world of Sherlock Holmes?
More recently, I would say I have been Gazagine. I am past Gazagine of Watson's Tin Box of Ellicott City, Maryland.
That's a good group.
Sherlockian Society. Oh, it's a wonderful society. I'm a member of a variety of science, including the Stormy Petrels of Maumee Bay, Ohio, the Ribston Pippins of Royal Oak, and I've lately taken in with a group called the Amateur Mendicant Society of Detroit.
I've heard of them.
70 years. I think you have heard of them. So it's a wonderful group of people. But my Sherlockian history goes back to age 10 when my mother read A Study in Scarlet to me, and I became fascinated with the stories. And occasionally tried my hand at performing some of them. And those took root in the late 1980s. We launched a series of Sherlock Holmes mystery weekends at the Victorian Villa Inn in Union City, Michigan, and continued to do them for approximately 14 years, and sporadically after that. I have been a professional Sherlock Holmes impersonator now since 1987. And that grew into a I guess a quasi-profession of sorts, because I've ended up performing as Sherlock Holmes, or I should say arranging for Mr. Holmes to make personal appearances in schools, libraries, book fairs, science societies, and so on since then. And I brought Mr. Holmes to 10 states and also to on two occasions to venues in the United Kingdom, one of them being the Sherlock Holmes Museum on Baker Street.
Wow, that's impressive.
Well, it's been a wonderful experience and a great honor, because getting into the shoes of the master is a lot of fun. And, of course, it's a double-edged sword. Occasionally people actually want you to solve crimes or something like that. And we've had some run-ons that have been pretty unusual. On one of our mystery weekends, we had a couple of people who thought the mystery was so engaging that they called 911 twice, and that had to be explained to the local authorities. So we've had some interesting experiences.
That's amazing. So before we get to the quiz here, why don't you tell everyone the honor that you were given just Saturday night at the Amateur Mendicant Society meeting?
It was a great surprise to me. I was attending the meeting of the Diogenes Club. The Amateur Mendicant Society. My cat is distracting me. She's trying to figure out why I'm talking to myself. And I was told that I had won the annual Beggar's Cup Award. I had given a talk the previous year on the fact that I have performed as Mr. Holmes for so long, and I regaled the group with some stories from those experiences, and apparently they enjoyed it. And I shared the stage with John Cram, who is the Gazogene of the Amateur Mendicants, as well as a BSI, Christopher Music. And we were all given the Beggar's Cup Award, and it was a grand group to be with.
That is. It's a fine group of people. Even though they meet in the lower vault of a furniture warehouse somewhere in the outskirts of Detroit.
Actually, the British Commonwealth Club. That's what we call it.
Yeah.
So, a wonderful place.
Well, you know, we've been talking a lot about romance in this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, in honor of Valentine's Day falling in this month. And as any Sherlockian knows, the Ferrisex, as everyone knows, is Watson's department. He's known for his experience of women, which extends over many nations and three separate continents. And that's not three incontinent women, just for you people keep track at home. So,
I would
John,
venture to say it's at least six continents by now.
Yeah, right. So we're going to ask you three questions about Watson's experience with women throughout the canon. If you answer at least two of them correctly, you will win our prize, which is a random item out of the IHO's Great Big Grab Bag of Gifts, or the IHO's GBGBs. So, I have to ask you, John, are you ready?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Shall the examination proceed? Yes, let it proceed by all means.
All right, the first question is, and this is multiple choice, so we'll give you all of the possible answers. In which story does Sherlock Holmes assert that the fairer sex is Watson's department? A, the Boscombe Valley mystery. B, the second stain. Or C, the illustrious client.
That's a toughie. I would have to say it is the Boscombe Valley mystery.
Oh, I'm sorry. In this case, it was the second stain.
Out.
The second stain.
It is.
They were there.
I wish I had one of my Watsons with me. Brooks Grant here, who performs as Dr. Watson.
Yeah.
I am in Michigan. Is not here to chide me, nor is Paul Churchill, the late Paul Churchill, I should say, who was Dr. Watson when I was on the East Coast, and who would often rescue me from circumstances when I needed data.
Paul was good that way. He was fantastic. Quite the Sherlockian and a great human being. Well, yep. The good news is, John, you still have two more opportunities to make right by Paul and by everyone else. So here we go.
If I get one of them wrong, I'm out.
Oh, we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. Yeah. Second question. Watson's only named wife, Mary Morstan, is a popular character to include in cinematic adaptations of the detective. According to the Internet Movie Database, when was Mary Morstan first depicted on the screen? A, 1923. B, 1968. Or C, 1976.
Well, I'm thinking that The Sign of Four had to have been included among the Norwood Silence, and so I will only say 1923.
That is exactly right. That is exactly right. Ely Norwood, as Sherlock Holmes in the 1920s, a favorite of Conan Doyle, that is exactly where Mary Morstan made her first appearance. So, good. You're 1-1 going into the final question here. This is how it heats up. We love when it comes down to the wire like this. When he first meets her, how does Watson describe Alice Turner in the Boscombe Valley Mystery? A, one of the most lovely young women I've ever seen in my life. B, her face had neither regularity of feature nor beauty of complexion. Or C, plainly but neatly dressed with the brisk manner of a woman who has had her own way to make in the world.
Well, what I remember from Alice Turner, she didn't have to make her way in life. But I could be wrong on that. But since Watson was always, he always had the hots for the, you know, a nice looking lady, the first one seems to be appropriate.
One of the most lovely young women I've ever seen in my life.
I'm very sympathetic in real life with Watson's demeanor. So, I would say that if Alice Turner were to walk in my room, I would probably say, "Hey,
well, you are right, John, and congratulations to you." So you will get whatever we happen to pull out of the iHose GBGB bag. It'll be something fun. And you know what? If it's something you already have, then I'm sure in your travels you can re-gift it.
Well, maybe it'll fit into my beggar's cup.
There you go. Well,
that would be wonderful.
Then it must be something liquid.
That would be all right. If you have something, just make sure that it's a legal substance.
There you go. Well, John, thanks for being a sport. Thanks for playing with us today and for being an avid listener and follower of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much. It's been an honor to be on the program.
Thanks, John.
Message for you, sir.
Oh, listener comments. Well, we've got a note from faithful listener Peter Calamai, who frequently listens to us on long road trips, which I'm very sympathetic for. And Peter writes, I'm a bit behind in my listening because not doing those long car trips as frequently now that winter's here. But I did get a chance to hear episode 84 recently. My ears pricked up when Scott said he had a complete set of the Renegade Comics, Stories of Sherlock Holmes, drawn by Canadian Dan Day, and initially published by a Canadian. You might be interested in reading an article about Sherlock Holmes in comics, which will appear in the BSI International Volume, Canada and Sherlock Holmes, scheduled for publication January 2017. The article originally appeared in Canadian Holmes, Volume 11, Number 4, in 1987 under the byline Dana McCausland, and it's been updated slightly, and the byline is now Dana Nunn, or Noon, Dana Noon, N-U-H-N. The book article is accompanied by an original drawing that Dan Day did for the first appearance. I wanted to make sure he had no objection to reprinting his artwork. I tracked him down to a relatively isolated rural location in Ontario. He still draws, but only halftime and largely sci-fi sketch cards, which you can see online at the Rittenhouse Archives website. But he's also completed a comic book about the Boscombe Valley mystery and may self-publish it. The 58-year-old Day frequently sells his original artwork at the Hero Fest shows held across Ontario, and he still has a dozen or so of the original Renegade Press Sherlock Holmes drawings available for purchase. Interesting.
That's wonderful. Well, good to hear from you, as always, Peter. And we hope you catch up on episode 90 here sometime while you're not falling asleep behind the wheel. looks like we have a note from Andrew Malik, who said, I greatly enjoyed IHO's 89 with Evelyn Herzog and Susan Rice on the origins of the adventuresses of Sherlock Holmes and the admission of women into the BSI. I had read about these events in a variety of places, including, of course, the 2004 BSJ Christmas Annual, but it was still a lot of fun to hear Evelyn and Susan at the same time. And excerpts from the recording of the 1991 BSI cocktail party were fascinating and moving. As Scott pointed out, it was particularly effective to intersperse the excerpts with Evelyn's and Susan's recollections of what happened. And in what order? Especially with the buildup of their belief that something was in the wind. But not this much. And noting that the first three female investitures were safe and that they were all for women very unlikely ever to attend a BSI dinner. Just had to listen to that portion again and enjoyed it just as much the first time. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Yes, always good to hear from you. Andrew, among other things, is probably the one of the greatest authorities on the life and work of Freddie Steele, and it's always good to hear from Andrew. Got to get him out of Minneapolis one winter so he can actually come to a BSI dinner.
Well, I hope you have a big shovel.
Oh, I've got a pretty big shovel.
It's usually used for other purposes.
Yes, yes, yes. It's warm from overuse. And then Ray Betzner writes, I drove home last night listening to your latest episode with a lump in my throat. It was a delight listening to Evie and Susan recall their early years as Sherlockians. But the clincher came when I heard Tom's voice as he struggled through his historic announcement. I was at the cocktail party that day, and amid the tumult, it was sometimes hard to hear him. Many thanks to the two of you, Evie, Susan, and the BSI Trust, for bringing that moment back to life. It was dramatic then and equally emotional today.
You know, that's a sentiment that I saw echoed again and again quite frequently on Facebook as folks were sharing that they had listened to IHO's 89, was that they were tearing up. They were getting emotional hearing about this. And, of course, you and I, you know, we talked to Susan and Evie, and then we had the recording, and then we edited it all together. But, you know, amidst that, all of that work, we didn't really pause to appreciate it. And you and I both exchanged with each other that we do go back and listen to the episodes after they're assembled. And the effect really was that remarkable as to invoke that kind of emotion.
That was really nice hearing Tom's voice again.
It really was. Really was. First time I heard Tom's voice was when I was in an elevator with him at the 1995 BSI weekend. It was in the in the Algonquin Hotel. Got into the elevator heading down to the lobby to go to the dinner, and I had donned a tuxedo. And back in those days, a tuxedo was more of a rarity at the BSI dinner than a regularity. I guess an irregularity rather than a rarity. And I got on the elevator, and there's Tom in a suit and tie, and he looks me up and down, and he goes, "What the hell are you wearing that for?" "Hi, Tom. Nice to meet you, sir."
Yes.
I was all of 24 years old at the time.
His typical restraint.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I have no chance. No chance whatsoever.
Yeah.
And then we have a couple more items here, some notes that we received from, here's one from Fatima Schoenfelder, or Fatima Schoenfelder, not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. She says, I am a fan of IHOs. Just to let you know, your podcast reaches those you may least expect. Take me, for instance. I'm a Ghanaian American mother of a 5-year-old who acts like he's going on 50, a puppeteer from the Boogie Down Bronx, and I am a super fangirl of all things Sherlock. You never know who you, IHOs, touch. Mm. Thanks for sharing your hobby with me and with many others.
Mm.
And then she included a wonderful sketch in her note that we will put in the show notes for episode 90, so you can take a look at some fan art from Sherlockians like yourself.
Thank you for writing, Fatima. And then Martin Marsh writes from Denmark. Hello from Denmark. First, I would like to thank you for a great show. I first found you around show 75, so I'm catching up on my way to work each day. And I must say, it's a great way to get to work. So thank you for the job you do, and I wish you happy hunting in the future. I'd also like to ask you if you know where I might get a copy of the Granada television series, The Baker Street File, with all the Sherlock facts that Brett utilized to make Sherlock come alive. And I've tried writing to some Danish Sherlockians to join a Zion, or what it is called here, but none have gotten back to me. Do you have any ideas?
Yeah, full of questions. I love it. I love it. Well,
Baker Street File is a rare thing, isn't it?
It really is. I found a copy recently on abebooks.com for $1,250.
Oh, that's cheap.
Yeah. And this is a little paperback book, a pamphlet almost.
Yeah.
Maybe 60 pages long or so. You have a copy?
No, I don't have a copy. But years ago, I was a big Star Trek fan, and Gene Roddenberry, for that first season of Star Trek, the original series, formed a little business called Lincoln Enterprises, where he would sell on the side copies of scripts and then copies of all of the material. And one of the things he had was a writer's guide for Star Trek. And so I bought a couple of scripts from him and the writer's guide. And the writer's guide is kind of what Baker Street File is. You know, it's the world of that they're trying to recreate there.
That doesn't really help our friend Martin out.
No. But, you know, it's one of those things that really should exist as a PDF somewhere.
Yeah. You hear that?
Yes.
Those are the pages of the Baker Street File.
Oh, I think there's a typo on page 37.
And I'm looking, because I've had this such a long time, I'm looking at the sticker on the back. I bought it at Murder One when I was in London the first time.
Oh, my goodness.
And it cost me £9.99.
Well, I think you could turn a quick $1,242 profit, or $41 profit.
But then I wouldn't have it.
Oh, and that would be a real tragedy.
I know. Of course, now that I've mentioned that I do own it, I may not have it after someone breaks into my house.
No.
It's insured, thankfully. Well,
that was something, isn't it? Somebody should reprint that. I mean, is it really, I guess, is it copyright? Who owns the copyright?
It was printed by the Calabash Press. I would think that, you know, with this title alone, Chris and Barbara Roden would be able to do pretty well, or to make an arrangement with someone.
Mm.
And this seems like it would be a great opportunity for our friends at the Wessex Press, too. I mean, given that they did the a study in celluloid with Michael Cox.
Right. Well, who owns the copy? Who's it copyrighted by, though?
I think it might be by, let's see, Michael Cox. And Stuart Dowdy and Nikki Cooney. Forward by Michael Cox, prefaced by Christopher Roden. First published privately in 1983, and this edition was published in 1997. That might be worth something.
Martin, it's certainly worth an email to Chris Roden. See what his sense is about that.
And in terms of Danish Sherlockians, I mean, boy, the Danish Sherlock Holmes Society is one that's been around for a long time, right? Henry.
Oh my God! Of course,
Henry Lauritsen.
Right.
Of course, and I just ran into him at the BSI weekend this year. Jens Bischoff Jensen, or the American pronunciation, Jens Jensen. a violinist over there. I think he's still in Denmark. He'd be a great one to correspond with. And then not too far away from Denmark, just across the North Sea there, is Sweden. And you can find our good friend Matthias Bostrom, who is a co-author with Matt Laffey of Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle in the newspapers. He's a gregarious fellow. He might be willing to help you out, hook you up with some Danish. Danish. Well, let's close up the mailbag.
Hello, hello. Zip. I don't know why you say
goodbye, I say hello. And on to our fourth and final sponsor.
All sponsors, all the time.
This is the all sponsor show. This is our good friends at, where are they?
The Baker Street Journal. Baker Street
Journal, of course. I know those guys.
Yeah.
If you go to bakerstreetjournal.com, you will find all sorts of stuff there. But I think the most important thing to focus on is the journal itself.
Yes.
It's the premier source of Sherlockian scholarship. And for 2016, you can get yourself a subscription for $40.95 postpaid. And that includes four of the quarterly issues plus the Christmas annual. They have not announced what the Christmas annual will be this year. But if it's anything like last year's, the retrospective on the 7% solution, the book and the film, it will be well worth your investment.
Now, I have the winter 2015 issue right here.
You do?
Volume 65, number 4. I do not understand. You must have this, yes?
I don't yet. No, what do you mean you don't yet?
It hasn't arrived? You kidding?
No, it hasn't.
Are you sure you subscribed? Because, it's only $40.95 for all five issues.
That's a pretty good bargain.
It is a good bargain. You should send them, Well, then you can't help me because I don't understand the cover. Well, I do understand the cover. It's a cartoon of Holmes and Watson. I should say an illustration of Holmes and Watson, but it's kind of cartoony. But I don't understand who did it and why it's on the cover.
Well, and this is something that ever since the Baker Street Journal rebranded itself and went to a perfect bound copy versus a saddle stitch, and have changed the cover art on every issue, I have suggested to both the publisher and the editor that it would be worthwhile having an on-the-cover description somewhere inside the journal that tells you exactly what the significance is.
Well, or who drew it. I mean, the New Yorker does that. The New Yorker has great covers every issue, and then you can turn to the table of contents, and on the bottom, at minimum, you find the title of the work and who the artist was.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the minimum that could be provided. And maybe there's something that's contextually relevant to the issue, that some of the stories or the articles stem from that. Maybe it's just because you wanted to feature something that looked cool and feature a new artist. Mm. But it might be nice to know who it is and where it came from at the bare minimum. Mm. Well, if you would like to have a journal that does not include that information, then the Baker Street Journal is the place to go, bakerstreetjournal.com.
Yes.
And I'm sure they'd love to hear your suggestions as well, so feel free to check that out.
Yeah. And by the way, this is a great issue. When you get it, you'll find an article by our pal Peter Calamai about journalism wellsprings for Neville St. Clair. Les Klinger has written an essay, Sherlock Holmes Among the Doctors. The Skeptic's Guide to Sherlock Holmes, 25 Facts About the Detective, are here from Rebecca Romney. And then to our prior mention about pastiches, the who, the what, the why, the when, the where, One Writer's Method for Writing Sherlockian Pastiche by Dana Cameron.
Oh.
And Tanya Pikula has The Hidden Crimes of Suburbia in The Norwood Builder. Scott Bond's Art in the Blood. My First Meeting with Sherlock Holmes is here from Jen, our pal Jen Eaker. As you value your life, follow me onto the moor.
Hmm.
And that plus updates from the Sherlockian societies and a discount on any honey-baked ham in your local area are all yours. with your subscription.
Fantastic. Well, we are at that point in the episode where I think we're a little bloated.
Well, I certainly hope this editor's gas lamp is about sponsors.
No, it actually harkens back to the last episode. You know, we had Evie and Susan on. We were talking about the adventuresses of Sherlock Holmes and the women in the BSI. This gas lamp is taken from volume 41, number 1, from March of 1991. That would be right after that fateful BSI announcement. And it is entitled Women. In the May 13th, 1934 issue of the Saturday Review of Literature, Christopher Morley published a Sherlockian crossword puzzle, together with a note to the effect that those who submitted to him correct solutions, but they must be correct in every detail, will automatically become members of the Baker Street Irregulars, Morley's fondly regarded offspring, which had never actually convened physically. Ultimately, some 15 people shipped off perfect puzzle solutions to Morley at the Saturday Review. Realizing, though, that his correct in every detail injunction was perhaps too rigorous, Morley relaxed BSI entrance requirements to include another 23 nearly perfect solutions. What's interesting about these data is that of the 15 perfect solutions, 7 were submitted by women. And of the nearly perfect, at least 5. However, in Morley's typewritten invitation to the first formal meeting of the Baker Street Irregulars on June 5th, 1934, he included, in an act of utter gasogenetic fiat, a concluding sentence that read, "This first meeting will be stag." No reason given. Possibly when he originally printed the crossword, Morley thought, in an uncharacteristically unperceptive moment, that only the boys would apply for membership. Perhaps at some point he turned to his brother, who had set the puzzle, and exclaimed, "Frank, women have done this horrid thing, too." But whatever the circumstances, June of 1934 began a 57-year practice of the BSI's being a solely male sodality. Never mind that the grill parser Sitten Politzei Verein, the Morley-esque club out of which the BSI evolved, was a sprightly intellectual convocation of both men and women. Never mind that the club's constitution and bylaws, composed by Elmer Davis in the BSI's natal year, clearly provided for female members. And, at least in concept, see Bylaw 3, Qualification A. And never mind that later both Edgar W. Smith and Julian Wolfe would invest women in the Irregulars. The former, Lenore Glenn Offord, the latter, Lisa McGaw. A quote-unquote tradition had been established, and among the Irregulars not a skirt was to be seen, except for a rare kilt. As it is with most traditions, the rationale for this one, had any ever existed, was forgotten. So, explanations were cut from whole cloth. There had been no women in Holmes's original Irregulars, nor were there any well-educated adult males, either for that matter. Holmes's animadversions of women were well known, though Irene Adler was as special to him as any man, save Watson, and Watson welcomed women to 221B Baker Street at the drop of a kerchief. Victorian gentlemen's clubs did not admit women, but the BSI never clubbed in that way. It was founded as a literary society, upon which women, even in Victorian times, attended frequently. In short, this exclusionary rule was as lame as a creeping man. Its only justification was precedent, a concept fundamentally valid only in courts of law. With this year's investiture of 6 women, what the Baker Street Irregulars have done under their enlightened Wiggins is, after more than half a century, to honor the spirit of the club's publicly stated 1934 membership invitation and the implications of its constitution and bylaws. At long last, the BSI is what it had said at its inception that it intended to be. And though some may fear it, we have not toppled willy-nilly into a mindlessly liberated brave new world in this. To the contrary, what we have accomplished is conservative. We have reached down into the rich soil of the BSI's genesis to find the bright seeds of our origins. We have retreated to the New York of the 20s and 30s, when the men and the women of the Algonquin Roundtable and the Grillparzer Club gathered to dine, often raucously, on steak, whiskey, and wit. We have reclaimed some of that hopeful enthusiasm, some of that genteel innocence. And at the beginning, we were innocent. Robert Keith Levitt, who was the party to the birth of the Baker Street Irregulars, reported that women were indeed present at the BSI's premier meeting, a publicity event largely sponsored by Doubleday and held at the Hotel Duane in New York on January 6, 1934, preceding the first formal meeting in June. Levitt admitted years later that he recalled little of the affair except that those assembled played a game called sardines, a sort of hide-and-seek in reverse. The person who is it steals away and hides. All the others look for him, or, if you understand, her. Anyone finding him crawls into the same hiding place, and so for each additional finder as they accumulate. At length, as you can see, the hiders, now being sought by only one or two questers, get very sardine compressed, but if there are enough pretty ladies, correspondingly happy. The birth of the BSI. Later, Levitt grumpily referred to women as grit in the Irregulars' works. It seems to us there was something of an approach avoidance conflict, as the psychologists style it, going on there. But for our part, the journal is perfectly serene. We will take the grit, we'll welcome the grit, for to do so is to cleave unto what we were all about at the start, the foregathering in joy of bookish folk of both sexes to celebrate Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. Now, if we can only convince Wiggins to reinstitute sardines, our traditions will have come full circle.
I am all for reinstituting sardines.
Sardines, kippers, herrings, whatever it takes.
I love that. It's a shame those kind of games aren't played anymore. I remember reading years ago another one that was very popular called Murder in the Alec Wolcott Algonquin Roundtable days. The anecdote was all about Harpo Marx, and the way the game was played was people drew slips of paper out of a hat, and one slip of paper had the word murderer on it. And so if you drew the murderer slip, you were the murderer, but only you knew you were the murderer. And so during the course of the evening, what you had to do was sidle up to somebody and what you had to do was, you had to identify yourself as the murderer, and whenever they got that note, they had to immediately act dead. And the idea being that eventually you'd find out somebody is missing and is therefore the victim, and then, you know, there would be an investigation of who was standing where and who was this and who was that. And the whole point was, apparently, to figure out who the murderer was. Well, anyway, at one of these parties, they found a victim, and they immediately knew that the murderer had to be Harpo. And the reason was that Harpo had written on a piece of paper, "You are dead." And he spelled dead, D-E-D.
That's pretty funny. So I wonder if a rather enterprising individual could go around and give that slip to people multiple times and become a mass murderer until there were only two left standing. A lot of fun. Well, you know, the problem with doing that at a BSI dinner these days would be 175 people. trying to play murderer or trying to do sardines. That could be a little difficult.
Yeah. Well, it could be fun for the cocktail party.
Well, we have quite a virtual cocktail party going on here on every episode, and we thank you for making that possible.
Yes.
We in particular would like to thank Mary Miller and Christian Mungard for their kind and generous support on Patreon.
What fun to meet Mary Miller at the BSI weekend.
Wasn't it?
Yeah,
at the Ash Dinner. She's a stitch. Yeah. I mean, just hysterical. Our kind of people. Yeah. We love that. I'm trying to think. I think Christian Mungard might be in Denmark, which would actually be a great lead for our friend Martin, who wrote.
There you are.
But if you're interested in helping, like they are, to support I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, as we have our biweekly episodes now, every other episode is an interview, and we have a lot of great ones lined up. Actually, if you're following these in chronological order, Episode 91 will feature an interview with author Maria Konnikova.
Ah, Dr. Konnikova.
Who has written The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time.
Yeah, she swindled us into doing an interview, apparently.
I don't know how that happened. Before I knew it, you know, the rope was there and the game was played.
And my watch is gone, I noticed.
That's it. So stay tuned for an interview with Maria Konnikova on episode 91. But in the meantime, if you would like to help support us, we are not Bernie Madoff-like at all. Go on to Patreon, patreon.com/IHearOfSherlock, or simply hit the Become a Patron button on IHearOfSherlock.com and donate to your heart's extent. We would really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I think we just need to wrap up.
Hallelujah.
And it, because Bob Elliott just passed away.
Oh, yeah.
Radio man.
Thank you for mentioning that. I'm really sad to note his passing.
Yeah, the end of an era there. But so much great material that he's left us with over the years. And as an inspiration, as an honor to him, I would like to say this is Scott Monty. Minding you to write if you get work.
Oh, and this is Bert Wolder reminding you to hang by your thumbs. And together we say,
the game's
afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.
Bob, have we time for a mystery, do you figure?
I think we could have a mystery today.
Right. Just a little bit. Just one or two murders.
I was walking through a thick pea soup fog on my way to Holmes's lodging when a young man came up to me and he said...
Holmes?
No, I'm not Holmes.
Dr. Watson?
Right.
There's been a murder.
I say, where?
The gatekeeper and stabbed to death.
Is he dead?
He didn't answer no questions.
I'd better tell my friend Holmes about this right away.
That's what I thought. I thought you'd like to know first.
Thank you.
But you're going to arrest me?
Oh, no, no. I have nothing on you.
I did it, though.
That's for Holmes to prove. I'm only his assistant.
And I'm going to kill you, too.
Oh, I see.
Time for one more murder. One more, Bob.
So he murdered me...
Hurry, though, or we'll only have to get...
I rapped on Holmes's...
We'll only have time for one little assault and battery if you don't hurry.
I rapped on Holmes's lodgings, and he came to the door and said...
Hello?
It didn't look like Holmes to me, and when he spoke, I...
Hey, Holmes. When I speak, you'll know it definitely.
I knew he wasn't Holmes the minute he spoke, because he told me he wasn't.
Come here. I'm going to kill you.
He did, and... That's the quarter, isn't it?
Well, I suppose that's enough for...
Sure.
Any more than that, and people would say it couldn't possibly happen.
We could work in another one if you want.